where did the concept of cultural appropriation even come from?
Where did it come from?
The idea of this inappropriate taking, right, has been around for a long time, whether we call it imperialism or simply theft, right? It's been there.
That is Susan Scafidi. She came to our studio a little while ago, and she is a preeminent expert on cultural appropriation. She even wrote a book called Who Owns Culture, Appropriation, and Authenticity in American Law. So she is like the expert on all things cultural appropriation.
I didn't know one existed, but cool.
Neither did I. And then she came through and was super helpful. She told me that cultural appropriation has only been an issue in countries with a colonial history.
Oh.
Because we have this sense that when there is imperialist action, we have one group coming in, taking the land, taking the people, taking personal property. Oh, and by the way, taking the intellectual property as well, sort of adding insult to injury.
So back in the day, the way we referred to it, and I'm not even sure if it was a kind of academic term or not, but we just called it cultural imperialism. Yeah, this is like 80s, you know, 80s when I was in college mostly.
Yeah, you know, and if it wasn't even being used in the 80s, the term cultural appropriation was definitely not a thing in the colonial era. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it hasn't been happening since the inception of this country. There are just way too many instances of cultural appropriation throughout U.S. history for us to name them all, from white communities taking on jazz culture in the 20s to the 40s. To white rock and rollers in the 70s personifying black musicians.
Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love?
To white actors like Seth Green in the late 90s, early 2000s playing wannabe rappers.
You know what that means, don't you?
Huh.
That means I got some 92% chance of embarrassing myself.
So, you know, even though we have all of these clear examples, it wasn't actually called cultural appropriation until very recently. So Susan, who wrote that book, she told me that when she was publishing her book back in 2005, she actually got a lot of pushback from her editor about using the term cultural appropriation because the editor thought that no one would know what that term meant.
I had to explain what it meant over and over.
Then something happened that helped make the conversation about cultural appropriation way bigger than ever before.
The recent dramatic rise in attention to cultural appropriation really has to do with the internet.
I was going to say Facebook.
Yeah, well, no, but you're even closer. You know, the internet, social media, you know, YouTube was created in 2005. This is where you can start to kind of peer into the windows of other people, not to sound like a creeper, but you really could see how other people were talking or dressing and looking and living.
Hi, guys. Thank you guys for coming back. Today's video is the last video.
Not only did way more people become acquainted with the term and the concept, but the way people talked about it just fundamentally changed.
Suddenly, we have groups of people able to see what other groups of people are doing, first of all, so there's this transparency, and aggregate their voices to complain if they find it inappropriate. We never had that kind of communication before. Over time, over the past really 5 to 7 years, cultural appropriation has trended as a term to usually mean something negative.
Before the internet, the only people who were able to comment about culture and have their ideas out there were academics or hoity-toity cultural critics from The New Yorker and whatnot. But nowadays, anyone can write a think piece, and therefore anyone can, you know, be a cultural critic. More often than not, those think pieces are often critical. And by the same token, anyone can put their ideas out there for the world to see and have their ideas stolen.
Oh, it's recording. Hey, y'all. I know I have.
Have you heard of the phrase, eyebrows on fleek?
Nope.
So you've never heard of eyebrows on fleek?
No, seriously, but I do work on my eyebrows, but I had never heard about that one. Okay, no.
Okay, so it's a phrase coined by Peaches Monroe. Her real name is Kayla Newman. She was an internet personality. She liked to, you know, make videos of herself, post them online. It was a cute little thing. And then she had this one video where she's in the car. She's has the forward-facing camera, and she's looking at herself, and she's just feeling herself. She's like,
eyebrows on fleek.
That term, Eyebrows on Fleek, just like took off and spread like wildfire. And it went viral, and specifically on Black Vine and Black Twitter, you know, just like the Black online community. Then you have people like Ariana Grande saying it.
When I get crunk, eyebrows on fleek.
Even IHOP was using the term on fleek. They tweeted out pancakes on fleek.
Oh my God, I feel so stupid.
No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. You know, I feel like IHOP should feel stupid because it's like, what are you using this term, you know? And that's kind of like the problem, because IHOP used this term for advertising to bring in more people and to seem culturally relevant. But Peaches Monroe didn't see any of that money. Cultural exchange is happening so fast today that the legal framework hasn't been able to keep up. So that begs the question, do we need a legal framework to protect people like Peaches Monroe who are sharing culture at lightning speed?
One action can have economic harm to a community. It can have psychological harm to a community. And it might even be legally actionable, although legally actionable, as we've said, is still quite rare.
You might be thinking that all instances of cultural appropriation would be misappropriation. You know, if you do or say or take anything from another cultural group, then that's some kind of inappropriate taking. But back in the day, before the term was so widely used, it was essentially a neutral and descriptive umbrella term that could mean both a positive form of appreciation, like learning to speak another language, and it could also be an inappropriate misappropriation, like a non-Native person wearing a Native headdress as a costume. So from a legal standpoint, cultural misappropriation is used to describe instances when someone takes from another culture for financial gain. So then I started to wonder, are there any legal consequences for cultural misappropriation, and should there be any? This is something that Susan has thought about a lot. I asked her about the laws around cultural appropriation, and she started out by talking about the main way that people and companies make lots and lots of money today, and that's by owning intellectual property.
In our legal system, intellectual property law acknowledges individual creators, the individual genius or inventor in the garage, the great American author, much more easily than it does any kind of collective creativity.
So, in other words, take the guy who invented the Coca-Cola recipe. It was invented by one person in one place and at one time. His invention is protected by the law. He can profit off of it.
But when it gets to ideas or manifestations of culture, it can be a little bit more difficult, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. So it's much harder to figure out authorship when something is created collectively, like, say, a traditional indigenous melody or a recipe passed down through generations. And so that's what makes those kinds of things easier to steal.
So right now, are there laws on the books that essentially prevent this?
Kind of.
So, in the U.S., the specific law pertaining to cultural appropriation really only involves Native Americans.
So, there's only one super specific law that prevents tribal names from being used in marketing, but not the culture in general.
And it involves either using the term Indian or Native American or a tribal name to describe a handicraft or something similar.
So back in 2011, there was this incident with Urban Outfitters. They came out.
Ooh, Urban Outfitters.
So back in 2011, Urban Outfitters, they came out with this line called the Navajo line. So they had like a flask with like a quote unquote Navajo print. They had the quote unquote Navajo panty. And they had, you know, shirts with like headdresses, and they just had the word Navajo all over all of it. And they're like, this is so cute, our Navajo line.
Uh-oh.
The Navajo Nation sued Urban Outfitters, and they won because the name Navajo was used in the products.
Had Urban Outfitters simply used the same patterns and just called them Southwestern, the Navajo Nation would have had no cause of action whatsoever.
And so Susan says that in general, it's hard to stop cultural misappropriation from happening. And this happens in all sorts of industries, but especially in music.
There was a song by Enigma. The German group in the 90s called Return to Innocence.
That's James Anaya. He's a lawyer who focuses on indigenous rights. And this classic song ended up being controversial because
the central melody of it was taken from the Amis people.
They're an indigenous group from Taiwan.
And the record company made a lot of money off that, but the Amis gained nothing from it. It was just literally taken from them.
So there was eventually a lawsuit related to the song. The Amis man singing the song sued the band's producer and a few recording companies, and they settled out of court. But this kind of theft has happened over and over and over again.
And you know what else? I'm sure that this happened to a lot of people, right? Which is that you kind of love something, like maybe that song, right? And then you realize, like, oh, bad. I need to be more aware of this.
Problematic faves. Yeah.
Problematic faves. There you go.
So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about cultural sharing. We're talking about illegitimate taking and profiteering off indigenous people's culture and protections for that.
James Anaya works with a group of indigenous activists from all over the world, and they've been trying to make cultural misappropriation illegal under international law. And there's been tons and tons of meetings and hearings for over 16 years, and it probably won't become law anytime soon. And that's about it when it comes to the law and cultural appropriation. But Susan Scafidi does have an idea of what could be done. And I thought it was pretty interesting.
My own suggestion for creating some kind of protective system comes back to this question of being able to label things as authentic. We could use our current trademark system in the U.S. to do something very similar. We have things that are called collective marks and certification marks.
Okay, so for example, USDA organic or fair trade, kind of stamps of approval that can be put on products.
There can be approval from a particular group of a particular product, or approval can be withheld from something that is not authentic.
So in Susan's world, if you bought a shirt with the Navajo print or something like that, that print could have a stamp of authenticity. And so when you buy that shirt, the profits of that go to that Navajo person or community instead of some big faceless corporation or someone who isn't even connected to the culture at all. And, you know, you could do this for music, food, or for anything.
Did you consider buying that from someone who had inherited the recipe from their great-great-grandmother, right? Is that possible for you? If so, then it's kind of nice to make sure that the source community is profiting economically.
So, Maria, what do you think about this idea? Like, if you were in a store and you were about to buy something and you see that thing has a label that says authentic, would you be more likely to buy it?
I'm intrigued by that, but I still, the thing that makes me uncomfortable is the whole notion of who gets to decide. And, you know, it can't just be one person, right?
Yeah, I see that. And I did ask Susan about this, you know, if she was worried at all that making laws about cultural appropriation could backfire in some way. And she said, yeah, you know, there is that argument.
Culture is fluid, and fencing off culture into areas of ownership will stop that fluidity and stop the evolution of human culture. We'll all just retreat to our own cultures, and the benefits of cultural exchange could be lost. Right? That's the scary part.
I think what's really important now in this moment in history is that because the demographic changes are occurring, that people of color, people whose culture has been appropriated, now have a voice in that conversation. And that's where I find it interesting, where it can't just happen and we have to be quiet. It's going to happen, but you can expect a dialogue, a conversation, and not the way it was when I was growing up. Power has changed.
You know, you're right. Yeah, power has changed. So, you know, whenever anyone does something offensive, it'll go online and people will be aware of it, and then that'll affect their business. So, yeah, there might not be legal consequences now, but there are definitely social consequences.
Latino USA producer, Zakiya Gibbons.